Our next case is State v. Lynn, 10-251, and we have Ms. Nothstein.
Yes. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the Court. The issue presented in this case is, can a defendant be convicted of aggravated burglary based upon evidence of having a purpose to commit an underlying crime that is different than the underlying offense that was alleged in the indictment? The Second District Court of Appeals erred in this case by reversing Jeffrey Lynn's conviction for aggravated burglary simply because the jury found that he trespassed with a purpose to assault his former girlfriend rather than for a purpose to steal, which was stated in the indictment. The state now asks this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and reinstate Jeffrey Lynn's conviction. The Court of Appeals believed the trial court erred by instructing on the elements of assault as a possible underlying offense because they thought that that would broaden the basis for conviction beyond what the grand jury had found in the case. There are two problems with the lower court's reasoning. The first one is it appears to be pretty evident from the record that the inclusion of theft in this indictment was actually a clerical error. It is unlikely, based upon all the evidence that was presented at the trial, which included no evidence that a theft was attempted or that a theft occurred. And there's just no evidence in the record of any theft whatsoever or an attempt. So it's highly unlikely that the grand jury actually did find probable cause to believe that theft was the criminal offense that he had a purpose to commit. And what the record does show is that there was no prejudice that resulted to the defendant because of what seems to have been just a clerical error.
So, counsel, are you saying that the evidence was presented to the grand jury that there was a trespass with intent to assault, and the indictment came out a trespass with intent to steal?
Your Honor, I'm saying —
And so that was proceeded to trial on a trespass with intent to steal.
I haven't reviewed the grand jury transcript, let me say that, but what happened was, I'm saying, based upon the evidence that we have in this record of the evidence that was presented at trial, which was so clear that his intention was to assault this woman. There was absolutely no evidence that he intended to steal. And the point I'm trying to make is that the lack of evidence, of any evidence, of an intent to commit a theft allows this court to at least, I don't want to say assume, but it tends to show that that was not presented to the grand jury as his purpose, a theft, because there is absolutely no evidence in the record to support whatsoever that he intended to commit a theft. And my point is that that tends to show this really was just a mistake in the indictment, of a clerical error.
But when you moved to amend the indictment before the trial, the court denied it because it said it would change the identity. And at that point, why didn't you just dismiss and re-indict properly? Because my concern is okay, this may be clear factually, but you're asking us to write a rule of law that will affect several other cases where it may not be that clear factually, and now all of a sudden you're indicted for one thing, and you're now, you know, trying to convict him on something else. He hasn't been indicted for it, and it may not be that clear, and so you're taking – it's kind of like bad facts making bad law. Why do we want to change the law when you could have simply dismissed and re-indicted with the proper charge?
I don't think I am asking you to change the law because, first of all, if I could address several points there. I think our position is that the trial judge should have allowed us to amend the indictment as we requested to, because it would not have changed the name or the identity of the offense. And I'm drawing upon what this court said in State versus Gardner for that idea, that the underlying criminal offense is not itself an essential element of the crime. The element is that he had a purpose to commit any criminal offense. And so
isn't that the essence of Judge Brogan's dissent?
That was part of it, yes, but I think he also agreed with my first point that this seems pretty clear from the record that this was just a mistake in the indictment. I think he mentioned that as well.
Isn't that what Criminal Rule 7D is for, to correct mistakes?
It is, and that's why I'm saying our position is the trial judge should have permitted us to amend whenever we tried to.
Is there some case law from our court that is compelling trial judges to decline the opportunity to amend pursuant to Criminal Rule 7D?
No, I think the case law from this court, going all the way back to O'Brien, is that Criminal Rule 7D can be used to amend as long as it does not change the name or the identity of the offense and the defense is not misled or prejudiced by it. And that's what we think would have happened here had we been allowed to amend.
Was there a bill of particulars issued?
I don't believe there was, Your Honor.
Counsel, I want to back up to, you're getting us over to a way to do this and get the outcome you'd like, but that isn't what your proposition of law is and what you started out arguing. You started out arguing, well, it's close enough, and I just couldn't comprehend. You need to think about what we would write in an opinion before you stand up here and ask us to do something like that. I just can't imagine what that would look like and what the implication of that would be to every other criminal case. Now, if your case is that it was error for the trial court to refuse to allow you to amend at the time that you presented that, that might not be a bad case, but that isn't what your proposition of law is.
Well, I didn't believe that that issue was actually squarely before the court, and the reason I didn't believe that was because she did sort of, permit us to amend by going ahead and instructing the jury on the elements of both theft and assault.
But you got to think about what we have to write. I don't see how we could possibly write what you're asking us to do.
If in fact the underlying offense is not an essential element, what I'm asking you in essence to write is that a trial court doesn't err by instructing on the elements of all the potential underlying offenses that are supported by the evidence, even if the indictment did not include every single one of them. And the reason being is, the underlying offense does not change the name or the identity of this crime. It's still aggravated burglary.
You start out asking us to presume that the grand jury considered and thought something else other than what they indicted for.
Well, I'm saying if you look at this record, there's absolutely no indication that there was an attempt to steal anything or that he did steal anything. So I'm just making
the point. So we start out by saying, well, we look at the record, and we have to presume that the grand jury didn't mean what it said in the indictment. It meant something else.
That's one aspect of my argument. The other aspect of my argument is that, frankly—
I mean, isn't that just a train wreck for the whole criminal justice system if we say something like that?
I don't think it's a train wreck for the court to look at the evidence and the entire record in the case and say we can discern from this that this had to have been a mistake. I mean, it's otherwise you're sort of assuming that we're over here at trial presenting evidence that's entirely different from something presented at the grand jury. I don't think that the court wants to assume that we would do that, the prosecutor's office. When you look at the record, I'm saying it seems pretty evident, but that there was a mistake that we should have been allowed to correct through the amendment as we wanted
when
to.
When that didn't happen, the solution would have been to dismiss and reindict.
In some cases, that would be possible, Your Honor. It may have even been possible here. But I want to caution the court that that's not always going to be possible because of speedy trial concerns. Now, I don't think in this case that we would have violated the right to speedy trial, but it's possible that we might. And I say that because time waivers, as I understand this, what this court said in State versus Adams, I believe, do not always relate back to a new indictment based upon the same set of facts and circumstances. So there might be times when we could not re-indict without violating the right to speedy trial. It sort of depends on how late in the process the error is discovered.
But we can't, you know, make a rule of law that's going to hopscotch around based on how much time the prosecutor has left to indict a defendant or re-indict a defendant. You know, the rules are there and allows you to amend. Obviously, you were not permitted to do so. Whether that was a valid determination by the trial court is not before us at this point. But then to say, well, we didn't use another tool that we have, and that is to dismiss and re-indict correctly, and there's no showing, you know, we could have used it maybe, but the calendar, you know, the clock was running, and we just decided not to. So, you know, I can see the fact that the name and the identity of the offense was not changed by the assault versus a theft offense. And I understand what you're saying, but I also can appreciate, you know, the crux of Justice Pfeiffer's question here.
Well, I guess what I'm what I'm trying to encourage the court to do is not leave us in a position where if we're not permitted to amend the indictment, as we were not in this case, I think erroneously, that then there may be no other option for us. What if how are we going to correct this if a mistake in the indictment?
Well, you start by looking at what comes out of the grand jury and your indictments to begin with, and you make sure that it's right. And now, you know, that if you want to go way back to the beginning, who reviews these things when they come out to the grand jury? And when you're the prosecuting attorney or assistant prosecutor and it's assigned to you and you see the police reports and you look at what your indictment says and there's a disconnect, red flag at that point, isn't there?
I'm not saying that there was not human error involved in this case. There was. That's the point. We need to be able to correct it. We should have been permitted to correct it by amending the indictment, is what I'm trying to get across. And it may not always be possible to go back and re-indict. We need to be able to amend this thing.
If we were to affirm and the court of appeals sends it back for a new trial, you have the opportunity at that point to dismiss and re-indict?
I do think we had some time, Your Honor, I believe. By my calculation, we had approximately 9 days. That's my calculation. So I do think we would have some time in this case to do that.
Excuse me, do you see Gardner as controlling then, back to Justice O'Donnell's question?
Well, Gardner, I don't know that I would say is controlling, because the issue there was slightly different, and it had to do with whether the jury had to unanimously agree upon what the underlying offense was. But there is language in Gardner that the court used to talk about the burglary statutes in Ohio as being statutes that only prescribe one crime with different ways of committing it. But each different way of committing it doesn't make it a separate – they're not separate crimes. They're just different ways to commit it. And so that language, I think, is helpful to us here. That's what I'm drawing on to say that to change the – we would not have been changing the name or the identity of the offense if we had been permitted to amend it. So I'm relying on that aspect of Gardner.
Would you have been better off if the indictment hadn't specified either assault or theft and simply followed the language of the statute and just said any felony?
Well, I think
felony?
We would have been better off than to have had a mistake in it, yes, absolutely.
And then with a bill of particulars, the felony itself could have been notice to the defendant.
That could have happened. I'm not sure if a bill of particulars was requested in the case.
Was there prejudice here to the defendant?
No. And the record shows that. First of all, there was, and I believe this is in the record, there was a preliminary hearing, which the charge of aggravated burglary was bound over after a hearing. And in that situation, theft was not named in the complaint at that point as the underlying offense. So before this man was even indicted, the defense attorney had a very good idea of where we were going here. with the case. The case was bound over. Open discovery was provided to the defense throughout. Montgomery County Prosecutor's Office always gave open discovery, even before the recent change in the Criminal Rule 16. And, in fact, the first bit of discovery was given to the defense attorney at the time of the prelim before Mr. Lynn was even indicted. You can tell then that further when you look in the record that once the judge announced her decision of how to handle this was going to be to instruct on both the elements of theft and assault and allow them to indicate which one they agreed upon, the defense did not request a continuance. They did not say, if you're going to allow the state to present evidence of assault, we can't go forward. That did not happen. And it did not affect their defense. If you look at their witness list, which was filed before we even moved to amend the indictment, and then look at the witnesses that they called, they're the same people. And the way that they chose to defend the case was to challenge the trespass element. In other words, they claimed that Mr. Lynn was actually living in this apartment.
If there was no evidence that the defendant, Mr. Lynn, attempted to commit a theft offense as part of the aggravated burglary, why would the trial judge instruct on something that there wasn't any evidence of in the trial? Was there evidence of theft?
No, none at all.
Well, why would the court instruct on something that wasn't evidenced?
Well, apparently because she did not feel comfortable with the idea of allowing us to take that out. She didn't let us amend the indictment. She ruled that we could not do so, and I think she felt that because theft was in the indictment and she was not going to allow it to be omitted, that she had to instruct on it is the best answer I can give you, because there was no evidence.
We always want courts to instruct juries based on the evidence and conform instructions to what the evidence is at trial.
Well, she did do that because the evidence was of assault, and she did instruct on that.
And did the jury return a specific verdict form finding assault as the predicate underlying offense?
Yes, the judge submitted both a verdict form and then
separate interrogatories,
and all 12 jurors signed the interrogatory saying that they did find and they did agree that his intention was to assault.
And was there a separate interrogatory in connection with the theft?
There was, and they said that they did not find that there was any purpose to commit a theft.
Which is why you answered Justice Lanzinger's question that there was no prejudice to the defendant because the case was predicated on assault, not on theft, and that was the instruction to the court by the court to the jury and the finding of the jury.
There was no prejudice because the defense knew from the very beginning, even before this man was indicted, that that's what our case was, that it was an assault-type offense, and that they had police reports, they had open discovery, and again, they didn't ask for a continuance. They didn't tell the judge, we can't go forward if you're going to.
Counselor, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Prendergast.
Good morning. May it please the court, Justice O'Connor, Ms. Nothstein. Your Honors, when the trial court denied the state's motion to amend the indictment, the state had options. In fact, the state had at least three options in order to remedy the situation created when the trial court denied the motion to amend. First, as Justice O'Connor mentioned during the state's presentation, right then and there, prior to the jury being impaneled, the state could have dismissed the indictment without prejudice and could have resubmitted the cause for a new indictment. Furthermore, at any point during the trial, up until the trial court instructed the jury, the state could have asked the trial court to reconsider its prior decision denying the motion to amend, could have asked that the trial court now grant the motion to amend use its discretion to grant the motion to amend under Criminal Rule 70.
Would that have been sufficient had the court done that?
Yes, Your Honor. If the court had granted the motion to amend under Criminal Rule 7D, then yes, it would have been sufficient.
But because the court had already agreed to do jury instructions on assault, why would it be necessary then to renew the motion to amend that had been denied?
Because, Your Honor, amendments of indictments are governed by Criminal Rule 7 and Criminal Rule 7D. And in this case, what the trial court said and did was to deny the state's motion to amend. And therefore, supplying the jury instructions cannot substitute for overruling a prior decision by the court without its express acknowledgement that the court is now going to reverse its prior decision.
Were the trial court's jury instructions on assault in conformity with evidence presented by the state to describe the activity of the perpetrator in this instance?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the court conformed its instructions to what the evidence was at trial, isn't that what we want judges to do?
In many circumstances, yes, Your Honor, we do want judges to do that. However, in this circumstance, Mr. Lynn was specifically indicted. The indictment contained essentially an additional burden of specifying the underlying offense. Gardner made clear that that was not necessary, that an indictment for aggravated burglary is sufficient if it simply tracks the language of the statute, which is one element being the defendant has a purpose to commit any criminal offense.
Right.
And had the indictment said that, then instructions on underlying offenses supported by the evidence would have been proper. In this case, however, the indictment said it didn't say any criminal offense. It didn't even say that Mr. Lynn had the purpose to commit any criminal offense, such as theft. It specifically said that he had the specific intent.
And was there prejudice that attached to your client as a result of this?
Yes, Your Honor. One can only speculate on there not being prejudice to the client. The indictment that the client was asked to defend against specified that he had forcibly trespassed into Marion Jefferson's home with an intent to commit theft. At that point, defense counsel prepared for trial based on that, to defend against that.
Did the defense counsel read the police reports?
I'm sure she did.
Did they take advantage of open file discovery?
Yes, Your Honor.
Interview witnesses?
I'm sorry?
Interview with the witnesses?
I'm sure she did.
And there was no indicia of theft as a result of all that?
No, Your Honor. And defense counsel knew then how to prepare its defense to defend Mr. Lynn, because there was no evidence of theft. However, the indictment specified that there was an open discovery.
But presumably, based on opposing counsel's statement, the whole case, the whole defense was, this wasn't a trespass. No matter what I did in the apartment or the premise, it wasn't a trespass because I lived there.
That is the defense that was mounted at trial, and that defense was the
only. So that has nothing to do with either theft or assault. It was negating one of the elements, which is the trespass, correct?
Correct, which then also had the effect of she couldn't deal with the theft or the assault. She could simply go to the trespass and try to negate the whole thing. Open discovery is not a substitute for a properly amended indictment pursuant to Criminal Rule 7D. Furthermore, after, I guess, the crux of the issue here, and I believe the state said this during its argument, is that it believes the trial court erred when it denied its motion to amend the indictment. However, in line with what I was saying, that they had options in order to essentially preserve that issue. One option would have been, when Mr. Lynn was convicted and had appealed, the state could have moved for leave to cross appeal and could have then raised the error with regard to the trial court's decision on the motion to amend. It would have been properly presented to the Court of Appeals.
Ms. Pendergrass, without elevating form over substance, I would really like to hear what the prejudice is that the Chief Justice asked you about, because the record in this case talks about a violent attempt by the defendant in this case, where not only did the police enter the residence and find him attempting to attack the victim, but that he made statements about when he got released, he would attack her again. So there was nothing in the police report or any of the evidence that I can discern from the record that indicated any attempt at a theft offense. And because the defense was related to trespass, I'm really struggling with how there was prejudice to the defendant in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. The clearest evidence of prejudice in this case to Mr. Lynn is evidenced by the verdict on aggravated burglary and specifically by the 12 signatures on the interrogatory that specifically states, we, the jury, find that the defendant, Jeffrey Lynn, did not commit the underlying criminal offense of theft as stated in the indictment. The prejudice to Mr. Lynn is that he was indicted for the state put an additional burden on itself to prove that he was trespassing with the intent to commit a theft, yet he was convicted of something not included in the indictment, and the indictment was never properly amended.
So because he was not found guilty of theft, he was prejudiced. That's what I just heard you say.
Yes.
Okay. But you're not denying that defense counsel had every opportunity and took advantage of every opportunity to prepare for trial.
Your Honor, defense counsel did take every advantage and opportunity to prepare for trial and prepared to defend against the charge levied in the indictment against her client, which is what her duty is to her client. Absent a proper amendment, it is not defense counsel's duty to guess at whether the state didn't mean to indict him that way, which is essentially where we're headed if we say that he was not prejudiced by being convicted of an aggravated burglary with the specific intent to commit a theft.
Are you suggesting that the defendant should have been allowed to benefit by the mistake of the state and that the defense should have been allowed to rely on that? I mean, that's what I guess I hear you saying with respect to the prejudice response here.
Well, the defense is definitely entitled to not raise an issue that it sees, if it's the state's objection to make, it's not incumbent upon the defense.
I mean, I think what I'm hearing you say is that, looking at this case and preparing for it, seeing the indictment and seeing the theft, which is not part of the evidence, that may have been part of the defense strategy, that this was a mistake that you could rely on and use to your advantage. And by not being able to use it, that's what's prejudicial to your client.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. And that the state had multiple opportunities to correct the error that essentially wants this court to correct. If the state had taken any of the opportunities, had it cross-appealed and asserted error in the trial court's motion, denial of the motion to amend, it likely would have prevailed and we would likely not be here.
So when the state moved to amend the indictment from theft to assault, presumably the defense attorney was part of that, correct?
Yes.
So they knew that, or she knew at that time, there is an assault underlying offense here, not a theft offense.
Well, I mean, yes, they discussed in chambers hearings that this all was discussed. However, defense counsel rather, filed a memorandum in opposition to the state's motion to amend. It was discussed at length in chambers hearings. She objected orally at that point to the lack of notice, and the trial court held in her favor. So she was entitled to rely on the trial court's denial of the state's motion to amend. Furthermore, this is not — the state wants to tie this to a clerical error in the indictment. And a clerical error is something that results from a minor mistake or inadvertence, but it's not a mistake that results from judicial reasoning or determination. And in this case, the alleged error, if it's an error at all, was part of the grand jury's determination. That is all we know from the indictment. And it is an error. If it's an error, it's an error of substance that could have been corrected pursuant to Criminal Rule 70, which it was not corrected by that. And If the court has no further questions, we would reiterate our prayer and ask this court to affirm the second district's opinion or dismiss the case as improvidently granted. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nostein, you did not reserve any time for rebuttal. Would you like 30 seconds?
Just, I would agree that we should have been permitted to amend this indictment under 7D. We tried to. The court did not permit us to do it, although she sort of did the next best thing. She basically allowed us to amend to conform to the evidence. And she.
Would you have appealed at that time with the denial of the motion to amend?
We would have had to seek leave to appeal. I think we. So I don't know that we would have been permitted to, but we would have to seek leave. In any event, she did instruct the jurors in accordance with the evidence, and it's clear that they had a unanimous verdict, and he was guilty of aggravated burglary, whether it was theft, whether it was assault, or some other crime.
Thank you. All right. We will take a short recess.
No lie.